We'll be going back and forth between Matthew, Mark, and Luke today. But it's at the beginning of Matthew 26, Mark 14, Luke 22. Okay? The beginning verses of all of those. But we kind of need to backtrack a minute and kind of figure out what's been going on and what day of the week. Remember, we spent months on that Tuesday that Jesus had so many different discourses or so many different conversations, lessons, teachings on that day. And remember, for the Jewish people, the day ended at sunset. So what we're, at least part of what we're doing today, is going to happen after sunset on Tuesday, which for them would be Wednesday, the next day of the week. But we had all of those conversations Jesus had with Pharisees and Sadducees and so forth on Tuesday. Then he went to the Mount of Olives, and that was on, I guess that would be like Tuesday afternoon, where he talked about, you know, Matthew 24 and Matthew 25. Sometimes it's called the Olivet Discourse. That's where he talked about the destruction of Jerusalem and then the second coming of Christ, and gave the parables of the virgins and the men with the different talents. That was all on the Mount of Olives on Tuesday afternoon. And then later, he's on his way to Bethany. And that's, so he's done all of that. Now he's leaving Jerusalem. You know, the Mount of Olives is right outside Jerusalem. So now he's on his way to Bethany, and that's where he's going to spend a couple of days. And on his way to Bethany is when he gives this, these things that we're going to talk about today happen. Okay? Though there's a few things where it's difficult to find out exactly, you know, when it happened as far as the time of day, but that's really not, I guess, all that critical. But this is about, as we've talked, you know, it's about Passover time, Feast of Unleavened Bread, and that's how Matthew 26, Mark 14, Luke 22 all start. For instance, Luke 22, to get us our time frame. Luke 22, verse 1. Luke 22, verse 1. It says, "Now the feast of unleavened bread drew near, which is called Passover." And if you've been here on Wednesday night, we talked about Passover, and we talked about Feast of Unleavened Bread. And those were two distinct things when they were first originally placed there by God. You know, Passover started on Saturday, and then there were 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So there was actually 8 full days of that. But by the time of Christ, those were kind of used interchangeably. So sometimes that whole feast was called Passover, sometimes it was called Feast of Unleavened Bread, and sometimes they were just all blended together, which is what Luke is doing here. He says, the Feast of Unleavened Bread drew near, which is called Passover. So that was all just kind of, like I said, blended together by the time of Christ. So they're both essentially the same thing. In, let's see, Mark's account, Mark 14, verse 1. He says this, "After 2 days, it was the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread." So after 2 more days, is the Feast of the Passover was going to start and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, let's go back to Matthew's account, and we'll read a little bit from that. Matthew 26, beginning in verse 1. Matthew 26, beginning in verse 1. "Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings," okay, now talking about what he did, he was on Mount of Olives, and he had given this long lesson, Matthew 24 and Matthew 25, about the destruction of Jerusalem and his second coming and how they need to be prepared. So after all of those sayings, then he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified." If I've counted right, and some of the reference I've looked in, that's the fourth time he's predicted his death by crucifixion. Fourth time. So they he had started not too long before this, but sometime, predicting that he would, not only that he would die, but how he would die. He would be crucified. That was the method that he knew he would die by. And so he says, the Son of Man is going to be delivered up. That process was going to start where he would end up being crucified. Well, it says, then the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the people assembled at the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and plotted to take Jesus by trickery and kill him. Of course, these were the Jewish rulers. You know, when you talk about the chief priests, the scribes, the elders, these were the Jewish leaders, the rulers of the Jewish people. These weren't the common people, I guess you'd say. And it says that Caiaphas was the high priest. And I got two different dates for the time period that he was high priest, because him and Annas apparently maybe overlapped in some of their time period. But anyway, Caiaphas was the high priest at that time. So he was definitely in on this. This was really a conspiracy, right? When you talk about plotting to do something, that's what a conspiracy is. You get together with other people and figure out how you're going to do this. That's a conspiracy. It's a plot. Yes?
Verse 4 almost leads you to believe that they had planned versus taking by trickery and killing them actually doing the killing themselves. It almost leads you to believe that.
Yeah.
And then I think because of the feast going on that they thought maybe it might be
secret yeah.
or subtle ways.
I think so. Because of the next verse says, but they said not during the feast, not during the Passover and unleavened bread, lest there be an uproar among the people. So they, you know, they were wanting, if they could have done it, they would like to have done it silently, quickly, before the feast, and it be done with. But if they couldn't get that done, then they were going to wait till after the feast to do it.
By using the trial like it is, it persuaded the people to be more on their side also.
Oh, sure. Yeah. There was... You know, I think the word conspiracy is very accurate as to what they did. There was a lot of planning and plotting. Yes?
It's like they almost think that the people are not going to miss him when he's gone. If we sneak around and do this,
right.
And we don't know we're doing it,
right.
That he'll be gone, and they'll just forget all about it. And, you know,
yep.
There wasn't a lot of... There might be a lot of planning, but there wasn't a lot of faith.
And that happens today, right? You can plan for a lot of things. Not necessarily a lot of real good thinking involved in the planning, but... So that seemed to be their desire. They, you know, they had reached a point where the only way out was to kill him. That was the only option as far as they were concerned. That was the only answer. They had to get rid of him and get rid of him permanently. Not just kick him out of the area. They had to kill him. Yes?
I think also crucifixion was the most evil and cruel punishment for the worst of evil
yeah,
doers.
Yeah, right.
And I think that was chosen by God in Christ to show a physical image of how bad the sins of the world were.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think there was definitely a symbol there because it was just left for the worst of the criminals. And I think there's a lot to learn right from that, no doubt about it. So that was their intention, and they, you know, they said, let's don't do it during the feast. If they can't get it done before the feast starts, then, you know, let's wait. And there was, remember, they have 2 more days between this and the beginning of Passover. So he said, let's wait and let's try and get this done. If we can't get it done in the next couple of days, let's wait until after the feast, because we don't want there to be an uproar, they said. So that was their plan, I guess you'd call it. So they wanted to be subtle about it at first, if they could get it accomplished. Now, Matthew puts this account in next. And when Jesus was in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, a woman came to him having an alabaster flask of very costly, fragrant oil, and she poured it on his head as he sat at the table. Now, some put this as the same account in John chapter 12. If we go turn over to John chapter 12 for just a moment. I won't read that whole account, just to... Now, in John chapter 12, here's an account of Mary and Martha at and Lazarus. Then it says, then 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, who had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of those who sat at the table with him. And then it talks about Mary taking this oil and wiping it on his feet. May or may not have been the same account, because there's differences between them. But we'll point out some of those differences in a minute. Some people believe it was the same one, and Matthew put it here to emphasize Judas's some of the reasons why he did what he did. But anyway, it says there was a woman there. It was in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper. She had very costly oil. And this apparently was an extremely valuable oil. Okay? Very, very valuable. And she poured it on his head. Well, if you remember, the other account talked about she did it all with his feet. Well, this time she poured it, or this account poured it on his head as he sat at the table. This very, very valuable oil was put on Christ's head. But when his disciples saw it, they were indignant. They were angry about it. Okay? Saying, why this waste? For this fragrant oil might have been sold for much and given to the poor. And that, again, was similar to the account in John chapter 12. Did Jesus think it was a waste? Definitely not. Definitely not. Because he gives them, and I think there's a real lesson here about the significance of what the woman did. Because he goes on and says, after they said, you know, why didn't we sell this and give all this money to the poor? Because it was worth a lot of money. But when Jesus was aware of it, he said to them, why do you trouble the woman? For she's done a good work for me. Good work for me. For you have the poor with you always, but me you do not have always. You know, these were all Jewish people he's talking to, right? They knew the law of Moses. They knew all of the instructions and commands God had given them about taking care of the poor. And the poor, there's been poor people from the very beginning of time. There will be poor people when Jesus returns. Now, he's not saying don't take care of the people. But Jesus said, I'm going to be dead in a few days. I'm going to be gone in a few days. So he says, you're going to have the poor with you always. You're always going to have those opportunities to take care of the poor. And we will, forever. We'll always have those opportunities. And those obligations to help will never be gone. Because they're always going to be with us. So, but he says, me, you do not have always. This woman recognized that the Messiah was here, and the importance of the Messiah, the honor of the Messiah, who he was, and all of that. So she took this very costly oil and poured it on his head. And notice what he said the result of it was. Of course, that's what I guess is most significant. He says, for in pouring this fragrant oil on my body, she did it for my burial. That's the real significance. He says, she did it for my burial. What does that have to do with his burial? Or what significance, maybe I'll put it another way. What significance does that have about a burial? Yes?
Other than the Egyptians, this time people did embalm, you know, stuff to keep the smell down. Mm-hmm. That, and something significant here, right before, he tells them in 2 days he's going to be there for his crucifixion, but they still, you know, I mean, this was, she did this, and they wasn't even taking it in light of what he had said about
right.
And she may have not either. I mean,
yeah.
She may have just been doing it to honor him, but he said, hey, this is for my burial, that she's preparing it.
Yeah.
And they were unprepared because they still don't.
Yeah, and he just said that, didn't he? He just said, I'm going to be crucified. He just flat out came and said it, didn't he? There wasn't any beating around the bush. No way that they could misunderstand that. I'm going to be crucified. Yes.
And another thing that nobody seems to understand at this point is they're not going to get a chance after.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. So he says that the result of all of this is that wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be told as a memorial to her. And of course, it has been. Think about how many times this account has been read or studied in the past almost 2,000 years. You know, just unbelievable number of times. So what she did, that one instance there, is something that's been remembered for almost 2,000 years. For people, as he says, all over the world have heard about this. All different countries and nationalities and races and so forth, they've all heard about this.
Does the same thing about her financial status, whether she could actually afford this oil?
Yeah, it doesn't say anything about it.
If she could afford it and she was in a financial stable state, then what she did do was very significant because she put herself as a servant.
Mm, that's right. Yep. Yeah, about any way you look at it, it was a sacrifice of place, a sacrifice of money, a sacrifice of her resources. So it definitely was. That's a good point. So let's read, let's see. Now, before we continue on to verse 14 of Matthew 26, let's go to Luke 22 and read one verse there. Verse 3. Luke 22, verse 3. Remember that it says in the prior verse, the chief priests and the scribes had sought how they might kill him. Verse 3 says, then Satan entered Judas, surnamed Iscariot, who was numbered among the 12. Why is that significant? Or why are we given that information? Well, maybe that's a better way to put it.
Matthew's account makes it look like that maybe Judas and the priest have been in cohorts with each other all along.
Okay.
And have been fighting this for a long time. But this explains it rather than just an instantaneous type deal.
Okay. All right. CL?
And it's his motivation.
Yeah.
He was motivated to evil.
Evil.
Apparently he was an evil person.
Yeah.
Yeah. When Christ talked about filtering into the treasury.
Into the treasury, yeah.
And so, you know, this was his motivation. He just, you know, didn't just think, why, you know, Satan moved him to it, or his inner being overcame.
All evil traces back to Satan, right? Now, that Satan didn't force him to do wrong. Okay, just like, you know, we go back to the time of Pharaoh and look at what Pharaoh did to God's people. Pharaoh was still responsible for what he did. And same way with Judas. Judas was still responsible for what he did. You know, we can allow Satan into our hearts in a sense and allow him to do things, but we allow him to do it, don't we? We allow him to do it, yes.
In a sense, same thing with him when he was out in the courtyard and he denied Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah. I mean, if anybody, you know, he'd been with Christ, but yet when he denied him, he let Satan overcome him because the human side of him yielded to that.
And that's what it's, that was it.
The human side of Judas yielded to this temptation, which to him was money. But.
Yeah. That's very true, yes.
Well, the only difference between Judas and Peter was that Peter repented.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean,
that's true. They both did the same type of thing, didn't they? Absolutely. And go ahead.
says, though, that Judas could have later even repented and been forgiven if he chose to kill himself, where Peter does repent of what he did and turned it around.
So it, you know, it goes back to those choices and allowing, okay? Judas and Peter both allowed Satan to influence them. They weren't forced to. Neither one of them had to do that. Judas didn't have to betray Christ. Peter didn't have to deny Christ. They weren't forced to, but they both allowed Satan to influence them. And so that's, you know, that hasn't changed. That's exactly the same way it is today. People allow Satan to influence them. Was that a comment, Dan?
Judas, his cost of that was money, which shows back to what people will do for money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll talk about, because that was even prophesied, wasn't it? We'll get to that in a moment. And that was exactly what was wrong there, because back in Matthew's account it says, verse 15. You know, Judas Iscariot went to the chief priest and said, "What are you willing to give me if I deliver him to you? How much is it worth to you?" Basically, we'd use it in our terms today. What's it worth to you if I deliver him to you? And they counted out to him 30 pieces of silver. And that's what it was worth. Well, we go back to Zechariah. There was a prophecy about that in the Old Testament. Zechariah chapter 11. Beginning in verse 12. Zechariah chapter 11, beginning in verse 12. Back when we studied Zechariah, we talked about this, but that was at least a couple years ago. Zechariah chapter 11, beginning in verse 12 says, "Then I said to them, 'If it is agreeable to you, give me my wages, and if not, refrain.' So they weighed out for my wages 30 pieces of silver. And the Lord said to me, 'Throw it to the potter,' that princely price they set on me. So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them into the house of the Lord for the potter. Then I cut in two my other staff bonds that I might break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel." And again, it talks about the wages being 30 pieces of silver. In verse 13, it's called the 30 pieces of silver, the princely price they set on me, 30 pieces of silver. And that was essentially, if you go back to Exodus, and we won't take the time to read it, that was kind of a typical price for a slave, was 30 pieces of silver. You could buy a slave for about, you know, about 30 pieces of silver. That was the going rate.
And they said for the potter, which the 30 pieces of silver, the potter's field.
Potter's field.
So all, it
yep.
includes it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Very true. So the Jewish leaders were, you know, they were glad about it. They got together with Judas to, you know, arrange the money. It says they counted out to him 30 pieces of silver. So from that time, he sought opportunity to betray him. You know, it would be tough for me. You know, Christ was with Judas practically every day, knowing what he was going to do. Because he knew. You know, every day he was with him and he knew exactly what kind of person Judas was. He knew that Judas was stealing money on a regular basis from the treasury. And then, knowing what Judas was going to do, the whole betrayal, man, that's tough. Yes.
In Luke chapter 4, he said he wants to discuss with the priest how he might betray him. And I admit, I really wish there was more detail because, you know, they knew who Christ was.
Absolutely. They all did.
And so, I mean, he kissed him and that signified, I mean, he was pointing him out in the lineup, so to speak.
Yeah.
But still, there had to be something that was said or done to betray him because he had to told, you know, be saying, well, this man's done so and so. But there had to be a charge.
Yeah.
And it doesn't go into it.
No, it doesn't.
And that, you know,
says very little about it.
And like you say, they've been together all the time. Now, if I watched, Dan and I watched 24, I don't know if you guys ever watched it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a bunch of guys in the government right now that's betraying the government, things that they've done. Well, you can see where they are sneaking around stealing to betray somebody. But how a guy's just going to show people that already know who this man is, that this is the one. Like I say, there was, I'm sure there's a lot more to it, because it says that he said how he might betray it, and they were delighted and agreed, and then they go along looking for the opportunity to betray it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. There's a whole lot of that story that we don't know. Yeah.
There's missing parts there, but yeah. I guess we don't need to know. Because the important says one of his own turned against
yeah.
him, but that had to fulfill the prophecy.
Yeah, that's right.
We wouldn't be sitting here today doing what we're doing.
That's true. That is right. Okay. So we talked about how they sought opportunity to deliver him so he could be, crucified. And go back to this real quick. Back in Matthew chapter 20, let's turn back to verse 17. Matthew chapter 20, verse 17. This is one of the times Jesus predicts his death. Matthew chapter 20, verse 17. It says, "Now Jesus, going up to Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples aside on the road and said to them, 'Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify, and the third day he will rise again.'" He predicts not only his death, but that he would be betrayed. That's how he would end up being crucified, is he'd be betrayed, but that he would rise from the dead the third day. He wouldn't stay dead. Yes.
And earlier we talked about the plot where they would want to do it in the feast, but then in Luke here, in verse 7, "Then came the day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed." So that,
yep.
that had to be the significance, because he's our Passover
yep.
lamb, and then he had been sacrificed on the equivalent day.
That's right.
Otherwise, all this, even though the old law is being done away with, so many things tied into
it. Oh, it does. Yeah, that's why it's so important to know that law of Moses, because you would miss so much if you didn't know that law of Moses, especially like some of the feasts we've been studying on Wednesday night, because they tie in. Jesus did so many things because he was Jewish and he was following those feasts, and did those things. But there is such an analogy between the two, between those different feasts. Very, very true. Let's. Why don't we go to Luke right now, Luke 22. Our time is very close to being up, but Luke 22. In verse 7, that's the one that CL just read. "Then came the day of unleavened bread, when the Passover must be killed." So this was the beginning, really, of the feast, but it was on Passover. And we talked on Wednesday night about the significance of leaven and why they, it was an observed festival. Leaven represented impurity and corruption. And so, remember, during this time, the Israelites had to go through their house, and any place they could find leaven, they had to take, it out of the house. For this feast time. And that's when this is happening. And again, there's great significance here about that. About getting rid of corruption and getting rid of impurity. That whole idea of what leaven represented to them. So it was all very significant. And just like during, when it was instituted, there was a lamb that was to be sacrificed. But it had to be prepared in a certain way, didn't it? It was killed on a certain day. It was prepared in a certain way. It was to be cooked with certain herbs and all, there was a whole number of things that they were to do. And so the disciples had to, go and find the lamb and get it prepared so that they could eat it when it was supposed to be eaten. Remember, it had to be eaten on a certain day, and you couldn't eat under certain conditions, you were not supposed to eat it past that day. So there's a whole number of things that occur, and we don't have time. We'll hopefully, Lord willing, we'll kind of get into the killing of the Passover lamb and all of that next Sunday morning, because it looks like our time's about up. But thank you for all your comments today.